Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
Hey, we're off. It's two. Right. I suppose it's midday, really, but like Friday. It's two. It's 2 o'clock. 2 o'clock rock. There are 23 others, but this is the only one that counts. According to Bill Haley, if he even does have kind of like any weight in 2021.
Yeah, I wonder how many of the kids know who Bill Haley is.
Bill Haley was in the top 10 charts when we were.
Yeah, it was. It's weird. They actually came back again, didn't
they? Yeah, like, but like, it was really weird because, like, in the 80s, we're number 51 in Malta. Hello, all our Maltese fans. In the 80s, there was an obsession with the 50s.
Yeah.
Because it was a generational thing. So in the 1980s, all of a sudden, everyone that was a teenager in the 50s decided that's the big thing. So you had loads of films. Like even stuff like the Blues Brothers was kind of like a throwback to music from the 50s and 60s.
Yeah. Benny King, I think that was the number one, wasn't it? With Stand By Me.
Benny the film King, brought Jackie out Wilson. That again.
Yeah.
Jackie Wilson, Rupert Seat.
Heard it through the grapevine.
You have all of those comedians that were all kind of, once I watched, I saw bits of Beverly Hills Cop 3 the other day, and it's kind of like you've got John Landis putting in all of that kind of like Motown music into it, which was like, I think that was like early 90s, was 1993, same year as Jurassic Park, Beverly Hills Cop 3. It was like early 90s. But you had all of these comedians that were sort of like obsessed with. And then you had Back to the Future, which was obviously, it's Robert Zemeckis and Bob Gale that were obsessed with their childhood in the 50s. So they wrote a film about it. And Peggy Sue Got Married, which was about going back to the 50s. It was kind of like, yeah, all of the filmmakers, what was cool when all the filmmakers were children, became cool in the 80s because I guess they didn't relate to what was happening around them. But even stuff like in Teen Wolf, when he gets on top of the of the van, they play Beach Boys stuff and you kind of like go, yeah. Like there's nothing, like all of the cool moments from those films are sort of
Ferris Bueller's Twist and Shout.
So, yeah. Which isn't, we're well aware we've moved to the 60s now, but so don't write in. but yeah, so there was sort of like, so in the 80s, there was Fats Domino, fucking hell. It was like the number one hits mixed in with Bros and Madonna.
And then you had Chubby Checker and the Fat Boys, a bit of.
Chubby Checker and the Fat Boys doing the twist.
Yeah.
But the Fat Boys had like a formula, didn't they? Because Chubby Checker did the Beach Boys as well, the Fat Boys versus the Beach Boys. So they did Wipeout, which was an instrumental track.
Yes.
But then the Fat Boys wrote some raps to it, and then also. The Fat Boys teamed Freddy Krueger as well, didn't they? And Freddy Krueger, when he was at his most prolific, was a paedophile janitor in the early 80s or late 70s.
Probably late 70s. Very nostalgic time, though, if we look back on it.
But he would have probably grown up in the 50s. I can't remember the storyline from Nightmare on Elm Street. And it's set in 1984. But he's already dead by then. So
yeah.
Who knows? Who knows when he was born? If anybody knows what year Freddy Krueger was born, write in. Let us know. Please write us in with that one. I think it was the 50s.
More importantly, what's your name?
My name's Nick Helm. this is Nathaniel Metcalf.
Hello.
And you're listening to Five Star Family Fun Size Fan Club.
It's like a cold open, that was good. It was like an episode of Law and Order.
I think that people just want to hit the fucking ground running. Yeah? Yeah. Tell your friends, by the way, guys. I think we can sprinkle it in throughout it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Or maybe leave it to the end. Like, that's the twist. You find out who we are and what the show is.
Like an Anne Robinson send-off. I'll tell you, friends. One thing I noticed the other day, I'll tell you what I've been a fan of this week.
Oh, yeah.
Before you get to it, before you chew my ear off, I'll tell you what I've been a fan of this week, Nathaniel. Mm-hmm. For the last few weeks in lockdown, I have been a fan of Challenge TV.
Oh, yeah.
Well, so you get the Sony Sony channel on what I've got as cable. I've got, like, the VIP Sky package. I didn't ask for it. They demanded I had it. So I don't know what channels you might
free?
Have.
You get it for free? Is that why they...
I'm pretty sure they've snuck in and now pay for it, but I didn't. I never asked for it. And I've had so much difficulty and problems with Sky. I don't think I would have.
I've tried to access the VIP channel, but all I can see is like a red velvet rope, and I can't see behind it.
Well, it's not a channel, Nathaniel. It's a whole package.
Okay. And
believe me, the reason for that red velvet rope is the stuff in the VIP section of Sky TV that you just wouldn't understand.
Wow.
I have access to Challenge TV.
Wow.
Yeah. I can watch as many old episodes of The Chase, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, just before this came on. I'm not afraid to admit it. Just before I came on air, I was watching Wheel of Fortune with Nikki Campbell and Carol.
Is that why you're on just before we started?
Because I wanted to know. Wanted to know who won. So I watch a lot of Millionaire. Millionaire's over on Sony Channel, but also Challenge TV owns some series and Sony Channel owns some of the other series. So every day, like Sony Channel, I mean, TV is fucked at the moment. Like, so I have Comedy Central. Mm-hmm. And do you know what Comedy Central's big thing is that they're doing at the moment?
I don't know. Cheers.
They show The A-Team and Baywatch.
I wouldn't really put them as comedy shows.
They're not comedy shows. I think that their thinking is that they're so bad that they're hilarious, but right. They're not. So you get an hour of Baywatch and then an hour of the A-Team. And then you have 17 hours of Friends. And then you have the same hour of Baywatch and the same hour of the A-Team to round off the day. So it is possible. I've caught myself more than one time of late. I've sat in front of Comedy Central. I've not. But I have a lot of episodes of Baywatch and the A-Team recorded. And a lot of them are duplicates, so I've got to kind of diff my way through that.
Series link, does it record the same ones twice then?
I think I did two series links. I just think I recorded it at night and I recorded it in the day, and it doesn't like, oh, this is the episode that you've already got. I'll sort it out for you. They'll just duplicate it. Which I think, you know, there will be technology maybe 20 years down the line where TV will recognise the content of what you're taping, you know, like a visual Shazam. And it'll say,
that could be a good one of Charlie Brooker's Black Mirror, couldn't it? Where someone finds out they don't have the same thing twice.
Or Nathaniel Metcalfe's the Dawn Patrol.
Yeah. I'll get on that.
Like the Twilight, like the Dawn area, like the Twilight Zone. I'm trying to think of don't sell yourself short. That's all I'm saying. I think that you've got yourself. Don't just give all your best ideas to Charlie Brooker.
I have
I've been watching loads of Challenge TV and stuff, and actually I find it quite enjoy it. I also watched the entirety of Your Honor, the new Bryan Cranston series.
Oh, yeah, yeah. What's that like?
Part three of I'm a Dad, his dad trilogy, starting with Malcolm in the Middle, rounded off with Breaking Bad, and then finished with Your Honor. Yeah, the new Bryan Cranston TV series, Your Honor. Watched all of that.
How was it?
Do you know what? There's some bits of it. I remember by about episode three. I remember thinking episode three is not very good. I remember sort of like by about episode three, I was thinking, oh, this is it. They've done it. He's finally found like a worthy follow-up to Breaking Bad. He could do this. It's an interesting character. It's great. But it's a weird series. I think with the Undoing, with Nicole Kidman and Hugh Grant, I think what I really enjoyed about that was that it was shameless trash, but it was enjoyable. It was a thriller. It's sort of like maybe it was slight. I don't know how much I've thought about The Undoing since I've seen it. It was probably disposable sort of trashy goodness, but I really enjoyed it. It was well acted. I thought Hugh Grant was brilliant. Nicole Kidman was great. You know, it was a lot of fun. I think with this, it's not Breaking Bad, so you have to get that in your head. And you're watching it, and you're kind of like, oh wow, this is it. And then every so often something kind of like, not, you know, shit happens, not for the characters, just in terms of like, why is that happening? That doesn't make sense. That feels like that's just been shoehorned in for some reason. And then it'll go back to being brilliant. And then as the series goes on, like I remember texting James Keel, my friend James Keel, and yours. The guy that everyone knows, he runs my third favourite comedy club in London.
Third favourite?
My favourite comedy club in South London, James Gill, ABC. So he recommended it, and I started watching it. He always recommends me TV shows, and I have to say, mate, I'm halfway through season four of Millionaire. Once I've caught up on this, I've got a lot of other. You know, I've got The Chase, Catchphrase, you know, Bullseye. I'm doing them all. So you'll be watching it, and you'll be sort of like tricked into thinking, oh, this is like premium quality TV, and then every so often you go, oh no, it's trash again, and then it'll be like, oh. So I think Bryan Cranston is so good in it that he sort of sells it as a league above what it really is, but some of the dialogue is terrible, and some of the relationships in it are just sort of like, why are you doing it like that? And I think it's I would say as the series, it's really great. Like, I'll give you an example of something that's fucking mental in this series. It gets to like episode seven, right? And it's this film about, it's a TV show about, there's a judge and there's a gangster, and the judge's son kills the gangster son in a hit and run mm-hmm. by accident. And then it's about them trying to cover that up, and it all spiraling out of control. That's episode one. And then and by episode five, I texted James and I said, how are they going to keep this up? I feel like it's over. It's 10 episodes. I feel like, where can they go from here? And James was like, oh, trust me, it gets a lot more tense. And it does, but it does start to fall apart. And then in episode seven, I felt like I'd missed an episode. Episode seven, it might be seven or eight, but I thought it might be eight, because then it's eight, nine, ten. But I thought it was like three away from the end, so I thought it was seven. They start talking about social distancing and corona. And then there's a couple of shots of people wearing masks in court. And then there's a couple of references to Bryan Cranston saying, well, because of social distancing, I'll just talk to him in my office. And then there's some scenes where one of the characters has taken up vaping, so she stood outside And then he sort of like stood about 2 meters away from her down some stairs talking to her. And now you're watching it because they brought up Corona. You start watching it going, well, this scene was shot. So they must have filmed 75% of the series without Corona. And then Corona hit. And my question really is, why not just ignore Corona? Because as soon as you mention it, now you're watching scenes of people outside and you're like going, well, they're only filming outside because of, you know, social distancing rules and filming rules. But because they've mentioned it, you're hyper aware of it. But had they not mentioned it, you wouldn't have thought twice about this character that suddenly started vaping, right? Because the vaping is an excuse to get her outside. Why didn't they just use Corona? Now they've introduced Corona as kind of like an excuse for them to... It's weird because it's one of the first shows that I've ever seen where it's like normal, 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 and then all of a sudden... and the way that they reference coronavirus entering into the storyline is so sort of like, you know, throwaway and offhand. You either admire it because they're just assuming that everybody knows what Corona is because we've all lived with it for 2 years. So it's either just kind of like, oh, by the way, Corona's hit, which leads me to think, we've imagined a world without Corona up till now. Just carry on as you were, and we won't really think about it. Maybe some scenes will look underpopulated, but do you know what I mean? It's like that Gillian White movie that we watched last week.
Yeah,
that was filmed during Corona, but they didn't go on and on about the fact they didn't even mention Corona in it. Do you know what I mean? There was a mask here and there, and I think that maybe that's the way to do it. Maybe it was one of the first shows to be finished off during Corona. They said, well, while they were making it, well, we'll have to mention it.
I think it's a difficult time because no one really knows how long it's going to go on for. I think especially in America where it's all still, it feels like they're all still amongst it a bit.
But what I would say about this series is that it's about these two families that are sort of like trying to sort of like hide from each other and get at each other and all this other stuff. So you're fine. But as soon as Corona hit, you know, everything ends. It's just sort of like, right, we'll put a pin in that. We're all self-isolating. We're not allowed. Do you know what I mean? It's just kind of like, we'll put a pin in all of our vendettas and all of our kind of like revenge plots and all of that. Because Corona is now the main storyline in everyone's life. It's not like a courtroom scene where he goes, oh, because of a bit of Corona, we're going to have to do some social distancing. Anyway, back to the plot. So it's kind of like, if you're not going to kind of like, it would be, it's, to me, it's like, you know, the movie Snake Eyes, mm-hmm. where it's a heist that is basically taking place at a casino. Is it a boxing ring or a casino? There's a casino with a box.
It's like one of those huge kind of casinos in Las Vegas. And it, or is it Atlantic City, isn't it? It's Atlantic City.
I think it's Atlantic City, and it's going to be getting hit by a...
storm.
What is it? Do you know what? I've not seen it. But, right, so it's going to be hit by this huge kind of, like, fuck-off storm, and they're going to use that to cover the heist, right? Mm-hmm. That's kind of, or like hurricane heist, which I have seen. It's kind of like, there's a massive hurricane going to hit, so we're going to use that to cover the heist, right? You've got this film that's kind of like referencing Corona, and Corona hits like this huge storm, and it cut through the nation, all of our nations. Do you know what I mean? It was like this huge sort of like global, you can't explain it in an offhand comment in episode 7 or 8 of your 10 episode series, and then just kind of like, anyway, there you go, here's the thing. And you'll be seeing, he may as well have said, you might be seeing a few masks dotted around in some of the wide shots, but just don't think about it. Do you know what I mean? It's just kind of like, if they're giving us enough intelligence to work out that they're filming under Corona conditions, then they should be able to give enough intelligence to just see a mask in the background and just get on with our lives. Do you know what I mean?
A bit like that thing where they say, don't, whatever you do, don't think about bananas. And you go, well, I'm thinking about bananas now. I wasn't even thinking about it. But now you said it, all I can think about is bananas.
What's that?
It's that thing. It's where if you don't mention it at all, you wouldn't think about it. But as soon as you bring it in and say, don't, whatever you do, don't think about it, it's suddenly... all you can think of.
I've never heard of such a thing. I've never heard of such a thing. But that is one of the jarring, that's one of the jarring things in the show, I think. Yes, it's exactly like that, Nathaniel. But it's one of the things in the show where it's not jarring. I'm not an imbecile. I'm not a child. Not all children are imbeciles. It's a different point. I'm just saying that it's one of these things in the show where you kind of like start doubting the process from the show. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of like, Bryan Cranston's good. Oh, he's real good. Hang on a minute. That other character, doesn't he seem a little bit superfluous? No, but Bryan Cranston's good. And then doubts start creeping ahead. And by the end, it's kind of like you're holding wet paper together and trying to say it's a book.
Because I think it also might age badly, right? Like assuming, fingers crossed, everything goes more or less back to normal by the summer, autumn time. If you're then watching this show, like lots of people are catching up on these shows for years. They watch in a few years, it might all seem a bit odd and a bit unusual then.
It was just so, I think it's because it was probably being finished while it was starting up, maybe, or maybe while it was like going on and on. It was kind of like, either make your whole plot now about coronavirus, or, you know, like the last four episodes are, we're all in lockdown because of corona, and now we're vulnerable because we can't get any police out in time, and, you know, all of the hospitals and the ambulances are sort of like taken up with corona victims. You know, make it that, make it like outbreak, make it like something, or don't mention it at all. And yeah, we can all be in our homes and just imagine it was, it's like, but they just do the thing. They kind of like go, oh yeah, by the way, there's some corona going around. But 7 hours into your 10-hour film, and you're going, oh, by the way, so, and then it has no impact on anything, and it's sort of, it's weird. Or just one. Also, there's three female parts, and it's basically they all do the same thing, and you kind of like just make them into one character, and then everything's much better. I have a lot to say about it, but if you've not seen it, and audiences haven't seen it, our listeners haven't seen it, then I recommend it, absolutely. It was a really fun, diverting 10 hours of telly, but also at the same time, it's sort of
like, enjoying on challenge, though, Nick, more importantly.
Falls apart. Say again, what am I enjoying on challenge? What am I enjoying on challenge? I've just told you.
The chase? Wheel of Fortune?
The chase, yeah, but the thing about the chase is I've never seen a whole episode of The Chase till very recently.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the things that surprises me is how long it's been going.
I like The Chase. Got a lot of time for it.
Well, that's a different conversation. But I've always walked in at random moments on The Chase, and I've never been able to piece together what that show is. Yeah? Mm-hmm. And now I've watched it from beginning to end, you go, oh, it's a lot more. Okay, so here's what I want to know about The Chase, right? Mm. Are The Chasers,
yeah,
one of the flaws, I would say, right? Because that's all I've got. I can now just sit at home and pick things apart all day, right? One of the flaws with The Chase, right, is that you've got four people that are all challenging whatever chaser it is that day. Sure. Who's your favourite chaser? Who's your favourite chaser?
I like Paul Sinner, the Sinner Man, or I like the Vixen. And I don't really like the others.
Who's the Vixen? Is that Jenny Ryan?
Jenny Ryan.
I've not seen any Jenny Ryan episodes. I've met Jenny Ryan. She's lovely. And I did her podcast with Lucy Porter. I was reminded the other day that Jenny Ryan is a chaser, and that's how I know her. But because I've seen however many episodes, and I saw one episode where Paul Sinner wasn't in it, and it was just the other three. Anne Hegarty as well. I did Crystal Maze with Anne Hegarty, so I know her as well. But it was okay. So what I would say is, my favourite is Paul Sinner. Not just because he's a comedian, but I think that helps.
I think he's quite funny. He's a human being, which a lot of the others aren't, I think. And I quite like he relates to people and will do something. I think I just quite like kindness the older I get. So he'll
he's
often
very
go,
kind. Oh,
that was really good. That was really good, he'll say to them.
That's what, exactly. It's really kind. Whereas, you know, some of the others just go as far as they can to be. You just think this is needless. The whole concept is weird because they've obviously got, like, whoever it was. So they haven't got, like, with Paul Sinner, they've hit gold because obviously he knows loads and he's like this quiz master, but he's a stand-up comedian, so he can deal with, like, humans, have conversations with people. But the other lot seem to be people that are really good at quizzes, you know, but
Social skills are lacking.
So they've been given this character, which is basically, you're a Bond villain, right?
Hmm.
And we'll give you this cool nickname, and you come out. But their social skills are so sort of like, they've got these scripted bits of exchanges and these threats and stuff, and they just come across as like pretty out of, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, see, Paul Sinner, who can do everything, who can like chat to him, show a bit of kindness, but he'll also go in. What do the chasers get a salary?
I presume so. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, right. So they get paid. They get paid every day, no matter what, right?
Yeah, whether they win or lose, I think they get paid.
Whether they win or lose. So what's in it for them?
Yeah, I sometimes wonder that, because sometimes I think, I'll just let them have 10 grand.
Exactly. Certainly, don't be a cunt all your life. Do you know what I mean? It's just sort of like, so I was watching an episode of The Chase, and they were going to make 30 grand between two of them, I think. And there was like 15 questions, and it was right, and 15 was like really slow. You know, obviously, like the chasing arm gets like 22 or 24. Mm-hmm. But they were juggling with 15 questions on this one. And it got right to the last second and the last, whatchamacallit, you know, the last question, the last second. And they like went, oh, it's John! And they got it in. And then the two contestants didn't win 30 grand. And you go, what's in it for you? What's in it for you? You've literally just... So either the chase, right, doesn't have any money, right? They've got no money to give away as prizes, right? Bradley gets paid. Whatever chaser is in the studio that day gets paid, but they're not all in the studio that day, right?
I would say the contestants rarely win any money on the chase, rarely win a penny. Yeah.
Because there's no money, right? The show's got no money. It's all been spent on Bradley, right? And then the chasers will do a block of five every day, and there's however many chasers, but they get paid per day. So it's just like, who's in today? Paul's in today. Anne's in today. Jenny's in today, is what I would assume, right? The way I picture it, because the fucking chaser, right, has to walk on and off in between each game, which is ridiculous, right?
I find that bit ridiculous. As soon as he found out who it is. The other thing is, I always think, if they're all in, like if, unless they record all the Paul Sinner episodes on one day, I also think, yeah, but you kind of think that, yeah, you have to have this sort of, this whole rigmarole of them coming in and out all the time. When you don't know who it is, bring them out and you can go, oh, look who it is. But after that, it's that thing where they have to keep coming and going.
I think...
Leave them out there.
What you can see is that it's kind of like they've gone, well, in some early episodes, I assume, they do this big crane shot where it goes over thousands of people in the audience that are all going mental for it. And then you have later episodes where it's kind of like, where you never see the audience at all. And so it's kind of like, okay, right. So I think that the initial game, right, is that you've got all four of the chasers or five of the chasers, depending on what season you're on, or three of the chasers. We've got them all, right? And they're all sat at their kind of like ramp that they're on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah?
And they're all in silhouette. And it's like, which one will it be for this round, right?
Yes, that's what I think.
And they all have a special skill, right? So one of them's better at sport and popular history, right? And one of them's good at science, right? And what you, they're good at everything, but they have like specialist skills, right? And it's kind of like, okay, so who are you looking for? Who are you hoping that you get this time? And then it'll be like, well, I hope I get Anne Hegarty. I hope I don't get the Beast, right? And then it's like, oh, you got the Beast. And it's like, oh, well. But it's like each person has to go. It's like end of level boss. Each person has to face their personal demon
yes.
in order to get through. And then they don't get through. I also think that the fucking chaser shouldn't get paid, right? For the story, obviously give them a salary in real life, but for the story, it should be like they're competing for the money.
For the money.
It should be like there's $100,000 in the pot and each contestant comes in and takes a bit of that money away, and that every time that they get money, it takes money away from the chaser, and the chaser is actually trying to defend something. So that there's some drama in it, because all that happens at the end of an episode of The Chase is if the contestants don't win, no one wins. No one wins anything. There's no stakes. It's just the end of the show. I also
think the other problem with exactly what you're saying is the first contestant gets to say, well, who do you want it to be? And he gets to say, oh, I want it to be the Beast or whatever. But no one else gets that choice. So you don't get that at all. No one else gets asked that because they don't have any say in it. So who do you want? And it's like, it don't matter. You got him.
Exactly. The other thing that fucking, just to finish this one thought on The Chase, and then we'll play some Alice Cooper, is that when you get to like the end, there's like two people, right? And they've made 12 grand, right? And then there's one person and they have a choice between making £1,000 minus £2,000 or £35,000, right? If I was one of the chasers left, yeah. Mm-hmm. With £12,000, and this person is going to offer £1,000 or £35,000, I would say you have to go for £35,000. Because they say, what should I go for? And they all go, well, it's better to have more people at the end than, you know. No, if you're bringing £1,000 to the table, right, and between three of us, we get £6,000 each if you lose, yeah?
Yeah.
If you just fuck off now, we get £6,000 each. If you go ahead and you get £13,000, now we get like £4,000 each.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes they even do it though, where they give them a minus number.
Yeah. And then I saw that the other day, this fucking, she came along, she took minus £2,000. So they went from £35,000 to £33,000, which meant that they were going to get £11,000 each. But if she hadn't got involved, they would have been able to split whatever it was. I can't do the math. But do you know what I mean? It's just kind of like it gets to a certain point where you go, no, you're better off not even coming through, because we can split this in half or we can split this three ways. But if we split it three ways, we're all getting less. Yeah. Doesn't matter how much of an... So if you're last, you have to take the fucking £35,000 that he's offering or she's offering. You have to take it, otherwise you're not welcome here anymore. This woman did minus £2,000, got through, and she had the nerve to walk back and give everyone like a pat on the back. The people that were left looked absolutely gutted. They were like, not only have you not contributed anything, you've taken away, we're making less money with you in twice. A, you've taken money off of the pot, and B, you're going to take a third of all the money now. It was fucking, mind you, she did answer a lot of fucking questions. Let's play some Alice Cooper.
Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're back. So what have you been a fan of this week, Nathaniel?
I'll tell you what I watched this week. A film I'd never seen. From 1995, Johnny Mnemonic.
Oh, yeah, that? Right, okay. Is it shit? It's shit, right?
Sort of. I reckon it is shit, but I reckon it's probably more entertaining now than it was when it came out.
Well, I saw that you posted a picture, didn't you? And it said the internet 2021. Yeah.
That's the opening shot of the film.
This is after Speed. This is before The Matrix. It's a rare cinematic outing for Dolph Lundgren.
Yes. It was in 1995. Good.
Is he good in it? He's different in it. He wears a big beard and he's that religious kind of
creature. Yeah, he's a bit like, creature. I mean, I suppose he's a bit like Thor or someone. He's a religious preacher, but who's also like an enforcer.
A fish out of water.
Yeah.
Enforcer. So I saw it at the time, but it was like to the point where it's a little bit like Mercury Rising in a way, where it was like Bruce Willis made Mercury Rising, which was a film about him and a kid that has like telepathic powers. But I think it was just 90s version of what autism is. Oh. And then you had Johnny Mnemonic, which was a Keanu Reeves sci-fi cyberpunk thriller about the internet and computers being in charge. And then they both went out and they said, yeah, and now we're going to make another film about the 90s cyberpunk thriller starring Keanu Reeves. And it's 200 million. We're making three of them all at once. And I'm like, what? What are you doing? Have you not seen Johnny Mnemonic? And the same thing happened with Bruce Willis, which is, I'm going to make another film with a kid and he can see things. And they were like, no, don't do it. And then it came out and it was like, it's all right, guys. It's The Matrix and The Sixth Sense, which were the same year, weren't they? 99.
Yes, they were. Yeah.
So, that's just me saying, yeah, I have seen it, but in a long, long time ago. So talk us through, how's it aged and what's it like?
Well, the things that are really good about it is that it's actually there actually aren't that many kind of sort of cyberpunk thriller things. And things like the production design, it looks great. That's what really struck me straight away. It looks great, except when there is anything to do with the internet or sort of cyberspace or anything where it looks like the Lawnmower Man. So it's got these sort of vector graphics and things cut in at a time when you kind of go, I mean, not even computer games look like this. You know, this looks particularly kind of a period. And it's very cyberpunky in that they've obviously, it's like they've read New Scientist and they know a little bit about things, but not enough. So he is a mnemonic courier who is carrying with him in his brain. He gets little things in his brain that he carries around, and this time he's been given the cure to this virus. But he can only carry 80 gigabyte of data at one time. But the data he's been given 300 gigabytes, which normally he'd be able to put on like a flash drive or something. But he has to carry it inside his brain, but he's got too much now, because he can only store... but like if my phone has too much, it just tells me to like delete something. But someone's put too much data into his brain, so he keeps having like headaches and things. And so he's got to carry 300 gigabytes of data inside his little brain and go into is it Los Angeles? It starts off in Beijing, but it's also got a really good 90s cast of quite cool 90s people. So it's like Ice-T, Henry Rollins, Takeshi Kitano, Udo Kier, Dolph Lundgren. So everyone keeps popping up and you go, oh, I like them. It's got like a genuinely quite charming 90s cast of people that you like seeing. And it's Keanu Reeves. So there's stuff about it that you kind of go, I sort of like, it seems like you're watching it and going, this really is silly. And yet I was quite enjoying it. Because I kept chuckling at little bits.
I tell you, Udo Kier popped up in Ace Ventura Pet Detective the other day, and I was like, fucking hell. Like, that's probably, every time I see Udo Kier in anything, I always go, oh, it's Udo Kier. Like, you know, oh, that's a young Udo Kier in Suspiria. And that's an old Udo Kier in, was it Dragged Across Concrete? No, it's the other one. Brawl in Cell Block 99. Mm. That's Udo Kier, Udo Kier. Where do you know Udo Kier from? Probably Ace Ventura Pet Detective. That's where he's sort of like indelled in my head.
What's weird is, weird, well, just having said that, what seeing Udo Kier pop up in Johnny Mnemonic, I found myself going, oh, Udo Kier, I think of him as being a bit kind of a bit of a quality actor. And actually, having you list off what films he's been in makes you go, that's not really true.
He's not. He's a genre actor, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
And you can get him, I like Udo Kier, but you can get him in. You can get him to do anything. he'd be a good chaser.
Could we get Udo Kier up?
But if they were like struggling to get their, do you know what I mean? It's just kind of like we want to get our money. We want our money back. You know, and it's really sinister. We want our money back. All of the contestants had like, you know, duct tapes to a chair with a spotlight, and they're like, we want our money back. And then they have to really sort of, they're competing for their lives as much as anything, the chase, you know. It's called the chase. There's not, you know,
not much
there should be some sort of, there should be some sort of physical element to it, you know. Starts with them getting chased, you know. Like they're surrounded by barbed wire fences and they're in like a scrapyard. They're terrified. So I put Udo Kier in it. But Johnny Mnemonic was like, it was sort of like Lawnmower Man and Strange Days. One of those films that was kind of like, this is set in the near future. So this has got a shelf life, guys. So enjoy it while you can. Like the Christmas 1999 movie End of Days that was all about the millennium. It's like, fucking hell, guys, you've got 2 weeks to see this bad boy.
That was bad at the time.
It was like December the 11th, and it's kind of like, oh God, this film goes off midnight New Year's Day. Midnight New Year's Eve. It was like, God, the fucking shelf life on that film. And then it's like, kind of like, even if it was good, you'd sort of like start watching it again, and you go, what's the point? We know it doesn't happen. Do you know what I mean? It's like all the suspension is kind of like, it's not good enough to kind of absorb you into the story. Johnny Mnemonic. Who was that? Oh, it was like one of those films that had like the tagline. I think Total Recall had it, which was like, they stole his mind and now they want it back. And now he wants it back. And it was kind of like, and the joke was, oh, Schwarzenegger, he hasn't got a brain. And the same thing was kind of like Keanu Reeves, isn't it? Yeah. He's got too much information in his head, and if it were like, not fucking lightly.
Yeah. And also, it's probably more insulting now because it's like going, he's got 300 gig in his brain. it's not terribly advanced, really.
Not very advanced. So, what else have you seen? Johnny Mnemonic, yeah. I mean, like, the thing is, I remember it on VHS, I remember it being boring and shit, and I've never kind of like given it another go, really. Worth it?
Something I watched that I was a bit disappointed in, which is a bit of a classic, was Once Upon a Time in America, and I don't think I've seen it in about 20 years. It's certainly not a bad film by any means. It's an incredibly well made film, and it has some great bits in it. And I saw the long version of it. I think there's an even longer version. The version I saw was a 3 hour, 40 minute version. It's a long old stretch.
I've never seen it. Right, I've never seen Once Upon a Time in America, and it was actually coincidentally this week that I found out that the release. I watched a YouTube video called "How to Ruin a Classic," Okay. And it was basically about the theatrical cut of Once Upon a Time in America, which has always been this... I don't know. I've seen bits of it. I just always feel like I'm not really into gangster movies, you know, for the sake of gangster movies. I really like Goodfellas. I really love The Godfather 1 and 2. Never seen the third one. And I love Sergio Leone, but I'm obviously more into cowboys than gangsters. And I think Once Upon a Time in America, I mean, I love Once Upon a Time in the West. What I think Once Upon a Time in the West, in America, was meant to be like Sergio Leone, kind of like, I think what it was that he sort of dissected the American Western with his Westerns. It was just like, this is what you Americans like. You like Westerns. You like good guys and bad guys. And I'm going to show you Westerns where you don't know who the good guys and the bad guys are. And it's going to be very bloody and no one's noble and they're all undercutting each other and it's, you know, a cutthroat, cutthroat environment that they're all living in, right? And then it's kind of like he went, I'm going to do the same thing with the gangster film. The gangsters film is an American film tradition. I'm going to do it. I'm going to take it apart. And I've never sort of like been that into it. But then I found out this week that the theatrical cut is not the preferred cut. And then I watched some interviews with Robert De Niro talking about that, how he'd not seen the new cut yet. And Martin Scorsese restored it. So he took all of like this footage that he found and Sergio Leone's notes or whatever, and then they put it together. I think they made it chronological. They changed originally for the original release. They kind of like cut out some flashbacks. They made it chronological and they took out the context of some other bits. So it plays very sort of like quite traditionally linear. And then when they did the special cut, they added in a load, like 40 minutes more footage, and then they re-edited it and they cleaned it all up. And I think that was the way that it was meant to be seen.
I think that's the version I watched. It's also the version I remember seeing on TV, which was shown over two nights, I think, because it's basically 4 hours.
Well, that's what they used to do, isn't it? They used to put in like loads of extra footage into, I think, The Godfather and Superman were two films that they used to... Have you ever heard that fact about when The Godfather first aired on TV?
No, I don't think so.
When The Godfather first aired on TV, there was a national water shortage when it finished because everyone caught up and went for a piss.
Because the film was so long. Yeah, everyone needed a piss. They went on...
So everyone, even though there are trailers, adverts in between, everyone watched The Godfather, and at the end of The Godfather, I think it was New York, the water level went down because everyone went for a piss and flushed the chain. Which, like, okay, so Once Upon a Time in America, Robert De Niro, James Woods.
Joe Pesci.
It's about Jewish. You're going to have to. You watched it, so it's about Jewish gangsters.
Yeah, during the Prohibition era, but that's sort of the main thing of it. But it's also got this. What's kind of interesting to watch now is you've also got the much older revisiting that time and coming back to Brooklyn at the time. And
but now we know what they look like.
Yeah, so it's that weird thing of. They are that age now or older, but they were playing older in the film. So it's got them as kids. It's basically the version you see is Robert De Niro comes back to Brooklyn to revisit his youth. And it's set over three or four different time periods, all of which you get in vaguely chronological order. But you also get this subplot of him in the present, which is, I think, meant to be late 60s, coming back to Brooklyn.
Where did you... do you think there's any mileage in the fact of like maybe someone like Martin Scorsese taking James Woods and Robert De Niro now and refilming those bits and putting them in?
I'd be kind of interested because that's kind of what it feels like. You kind of think of it like while you're watching it, your mind is now saying, oh, right, yeah, there's Robert De Niro from now. But it's not, of course. You're looking at Robert De Niro from 35 years ago and going, oh yeah, of course, this isn't, he's actually the same age he is as a young man in this. He's not at all the older one. But I don't think it'd be much mileage in it. I think your brain already does that trick.
Okay. And so where do you see this version? Is this the...
It's on Amazon Prime. It's on Amazon Prime. And I don't know.
It's the version. Do you think it's the version?
I think
it's like when they added the scenes to Once Upon a Time. No, The Bad and the Ugly. Have you ever seen the long extended version of that?
I thought I had. How long is that? Maybe I've just seen one that's...
I think it's like 4 hours. I think the original is 3 hours, and this one's like three and three quarters.
Oh, I don't know if they I have.
Or maybe it's 3:20. They put in a bunch of scenes, and that gives it a little bit more context because they didn't film sound at the time. They it was before Eli Wallach died. So they got Eli Wallach, Clint Eastwood, and a Lee Van Cleef impersonator to come in.
Yes, I did.
And do their voices. So it's great because they've got two of the original three to come back and do it. But it's weird because they're old men. So you'll have a scene where you've got Eli Wallach talking like he did in the 60s, and then he's come back as this very, very old man who's doing this voice. And he sounds like this, but he looks young, but he sounds like this. And you've got Clint Eastwood with his deep voice, and then you've got this guy come along doing a Lee Van Cleef impression who sounds like Lee Van Cleef. It's great. I mean, it's just, do you see, Nathaniel, this is what I like. It's not like, I liked the new Transformers film. It filled up 2 hours, and now what's next? It's just, I love how these things are handmade. They're like, you know, you can see the joints. And when they've added the film in, because of the way they made it, it affects the restoration process. The way they made it was they didn't film any sound. And then years later, when they put the bits in, they had to work. There was like a problem to solve. And it's beautiful that this thing exists. And it's great. It's like Martin Scorsese loves film so much that he went back and he kind of did a favour to Sergio Leone.
Oh, I think that's great. I think, you know, more power to him. Good for him. I think so you should. So you should do that to make it the proper version. That's the right thing to do.
I love films, Nathaniel, but then you didn't love it. And that's kind of like why I've avoided it. I feel like it's the last, I've not ever got all the way through Scarface either, but I feel like it's the last classic that I'm kind of like putting off. I'm frozen. Am I still frozen, Nathaniel?
You are, but I can hear you, or you're a little bit,
Why on earth am I frozen? Doesn't matter. Anyway, we're going to do some... do you know what? I love talking about films with you, Nathaniel. I think sometimes you're the only person in the world that gets me. So thank you. I'm slightly glitchy today. Oh, that's Natalie. See, it's like it's a tale of two cities. I'll tell you what I did watch fucking this week. Nutty Professor.
Oh, yeah.
Oh my God, that's an incredible film. It has its cake and eats it. Because I've grown up with weight problems and I find fat jokes in films incredibly hurtful. And this film has loads of fat jokes in it, which technically I would find upsetting. But because of the amount of heart it's got and the message it's got, it's such a... Eddie Murphy is so good in The Nutty Professor. It's absolute, you know, just the difference between Buddy Love and Sherman Klump. Huge. But then as the mum and the dad and the brother and the grandma and Richard Simmons, like, he's absolutely outstanding in that film. What an amazing movie, The Nutty Professor. Never seen The Clumps. Can I give that a go this week? Fan mail.
Is there just two?
It's just two. Should have been. And then
three.
Then he did Dr. Doolittle and he kind of like got lazy again. But anyway, here we go. Hey guys, I was a fan of the stand-up for Kansas Bill and Nick was a part of. I was a bit sad it was over so soon. Did they say why they didn't want to make it into a series? Did they say why they didn't want to make it into a series? Why have you gone into it with a fucking...
You only watched one of them. There are two of them.
There's two episodes. It was a two-episode special.
And then it finishes. It quite plainly has a conclusion.
There's a beginning and an end. Which means, did they stay? Did they, what? While we were making it, they said, "Oh, do you know what, Nick? Thanks for coming in. We're so sad that it wasn't a whole thing. It was. It was two episodes. It was like 2 hours. What are Nick's thoughts on making? What are Nick's thoughts on making the show? I have been having a Jason Pittman marathon recently. I was unaware of how many of his films from the last 10 years I was not aware of. I particularly enjoyed Bad Words. Bad Words. I saw that in. It feels like an Uncle ripoff, one of many. it's about a guy teaching a little kid how to swear on the way to a spelling bee.
Oh yeah, I remember that.
That could have been like a lost episode. Extract and Disconnect. Have you seen any of these? They're on Prime. Thoughts on Bateman. Enjoying Nat's new podcast. All the best, friend. Congratulations with your new podcast, Nat. How are you doing in Malta?
Do you know what? I haven't seen our Maltese.
Wind your neck in.
Well, I know we are currently 51 in Malta.
I don't really listen to podcasts, but I'm going to... I've got a new phone, so I'll set my phone up and I'll listen to your podcast. Are you enjoying doing it?
Yeah, it's fun. It's fun. It's nice to see people.
Must be nice to talk. Virtually. Must be nice to talk.
It is.
Yeah, I imagine. So, I really loved making the Stoke for Cancelling. But I guess we'll talk about it in the second half, maybe.
Probably will. I like Bateman.
I like Bateman. I really like Bateman in Arrested Development. Nothing controversial there. So I think he got a bit like the go-to guy. I keep thinking he's in the Hangover movies. He's not in the Hangover movies, but you can imagine that he would be.
Yeah. It's funny that he has that thing that he was in Teen Wolf 2, and at the time he was in The Hogan Family, which was kind of a bit of a Family Ties sort of knockoff show, really, and Valerie. Right. And then he was Teen Wolf 2, where he was sort of like a version of Michael J. Fox. And I think I've spent his whole career going, oh, yeah, he's like the other Michael J. Fox guy. And it feels like they might well have had a similar trajectory, I guess.
Every time I see him, I'm absolutely stunned that it's the guy from Teen Wolf 2. Mm. Like, I remember seeing Teen Wolf 2 at the cinema, and the fact that he went on to have like this huge successful career, he'll always be the guy from Teen Wolf 2 to me. So I can't really... But he's great, obviously. You've got to say that. He was great in Starsky and Hutch when he first turned up in Starsky and Hutch. It was like, and Jason Bateman. It's kind of like... Well, from Teen Wolf 2. Good for him. He's landed on his feet. Like a wolf would. Thank you so much for listening. We will be joined by our guest, Baroness Saeed Varsi, tomorrow.
Today I live, I want to be a day to give the best of me. I'm only one, but not alone. My finest day is yet unknown. I broke my heart for every gain. To taste the sweet, I face the pain. I rise and fall, yet through it all, this much remains.
Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're back. We're back. We've just been listening to Whitney Houston's One Moment in Time, if you're listening to it live. And if you're not listening to it live as a download, then you haven't got any of the music, so it doesn't really matter what we play.
Probably talk about it, though, in a minute.
But anyway, we're back. We're back live. We're not live, we're pre-recorded we're not in the studio, I'm in my office and Nat is in his washroom, and we're joined now by the legendary Baroness Saida Varsi. Hello.
Hi Nick, hi Nat.
Hello, we're just talking before about, I didn't know how to address you.
Yeah, well I think Saida will do for today.
Okay.
Okay. Yes. This is we know each other because we've worked with each other. It's kind of like this is my other partner, Nathaniel Metcalf, and now you're meeting.
Who's better, Nick? Who's better to work with, me or Nat?
Nat is a lot more. You both have your positives.
What were you going to say?
No, it's great. I love you both. Good, right? We've just been listening to why did you pick? We don't normally do this, but why did you pick Whitney Houston's "One Moment in Time" as your favourite song of all time?
I think two reasons. One, because it's just this great, big, thumping kind of Whitney Houston song, isn't it? But secondly, I think when I first heard it, it was at a really interesting time in my life, and it meant something to me at the time. And I think every time I now listen to it, it brings back that moment. And it was that moment of, for me, where I was thinking, you know, what do I do next? How do I step up from here? It brings back memories for me. And I also think it's just one of those really big kind of female empowerment, I'm the Baroness bitches song, really.
Sure. I know that when I was growing up in London, my mum was a really big Whitney Houston fan, as we call her, and I used to be left in the car with I can't remember what the album's called, but it was the one where she's wearing the white top and there's a blue background and it's got "I Want to Dance with Somebody" on it. It was that, Pet Shop Boys and Erasure, and my mum would
proper music.
It was like proper 80s, and it was like my mum would leave me in the car while she's picking up my sister, and I'd just listen to Whitney Houston, Pet Shop Boys, and Erasure. What did you used to listen to when you were growing up, Nathaniel?
What did I used to listen to? The first things I kind of remember listening to were things like Shakin' Stevens.
Very similar.
The album was just called Whitney, Nick.
Yes, I saw that.
It was one moment in time and you were going from one thing to another, what things are we talking about? What moment in time was it for you, Saida?
I think the kind of, for me, I mean, I don't associate it with the late 80s. I think I really associate it with the early 90s and the 90s. And I think there were two probably big moments. One, a sense that you could be anybody that you wanted to be. So we were of that generation that moved really from being really at the bottom of the pile to thinking they could do more than that. So I think there was that moment from the 80s, 90s through university, through becoming a lawyer. And then I think later on in life, I associate it a lot with the kind of moment post the disintegration of my first marriage, just to say, actually, there's something beyond this. And, you know, I've got to be able to kind of have the space to breathe and think that I can be somebody else other than this person who I'm expected to be. So I think it meant a lot to me. And every time I listen to it now, it still takes me right back to those moments.
Hmm. And you're a life peer of the House of Lords. How do I become a member of the House of Lords? How does that happen?
Two ways. Mm-hmm. You can either, well, three ways actually. Either your dad has to be a hereditary peer, Okay. And when he passes on, he'll pass his title on to you, and you will take on the, you know, the, if, you know, the dukedom or the earldom or whatever it may happen to be. And you could be elected. I don't know if that's going to happen. Secondly, you can be appointed by a panel. So every year there's an independent panel that appoint a number of people to the House of Lords, and they normally sit as crossbenchers. So they're independent of party politics, and they're there and they bring some expertise to the House. And I think Martha Lane Fox, for example, was somebody who was appointed like that. And then you can be appointed through the political process. So the Labour Party, the Liberal Democrats, and the Conservative Party will appoint people who they think are experts to come and sit in the House to scrutinise legislation. So yeah, politics, crossbench, or posh dad.
Okay, so you were brought in as an expert, is that right?
Yeah, which is a bit of a joke, really, because I was only 36, so I don't know what expert opinion I was giving. I was a really odd appointment to the House of Lords, because the average age in the House of Lords is 69.
Sure.
When I joined, I was 36. And although I'd had a great first career as a lawyer, and I'd been involved in politics and lots of policy areas, I know the reason why I was appointed was because we thought we were about to go into a general election. I don't know if you remember when Blair stood down, Brown took over, mm-hmm. and then we thought mm-hmm. Brown was going to call an election, and then he bottled it. And I think at that point, we actually thought Brown was going to call an election, Gordon Brown. And so David Cameron was putting together his team that would take him into the next election and his shadow cabinet team. And he asked me to join the shadow cabinet. And because I wasn't a member of the Commons, the only way I could take up a shadow cabinet seat was to join the Lords, because I needed to be a parliamentarian. So for me, I think joining the House of Lords was a byproduct of doing the job in shadow cabinet.
Right. So you're then brought into the House of Lords as you're an expert, and you've got that position now until you die, presumably. I don't want to bring us down, but you can presumably have it for the rest of your life. It's a life sentence.
It is a life sentence. And you know, it's, I mean, to be fair, the first, so as soon as I came in, I didn't come in as a backbencher. I came in as a shadow minister. So I was on the front bench, and I was taking through legislation. And the Equalities Act was one of the first pieces of legislation that I worked on. And to some extent, I probably was an expert when it came to that piece of legislation because of the work that I'd done. But I think also because I was, a lot of lawyers can turn their hand to politics quite easily, because you go from kind of arguing the law and implementing the law to making the law. So you get legislation, you get how legislation is made, you get how legislation is supposed to be implemented. So it wasn't a big job, a big jump for me. It was kind of standing before a judge and making the case to standing at the dispatch box and making the case.
Does that help with your presentation skills when you have to stand up in front of a big group of people and say?
I think when you've had the judge shout at you enough times and say, "What's the point you're making, Miss Farsi?" You know, as I used to get often, or "Can you get to the point?" I think when you've had your butt whipped a few times in court, and you've had colleagues kind of intervene on you in the House of Lords, you have to develop the skill to be able to say what you mean and say it quickly and say it clearly and coherently and get on with it. Mm. So I think when we were doing the Stand Up to Cancer, Nick, that, you know, the one thing that I was obsessive about was 5 minutes. If we've been told to do a 5-minute sketch, it's got to be 5 minutes. And I think that ability to be able to condense stuff and find the words to say things quickly and sharply is something that, you know, lawyers and politicians, I think, develop.
Well, that is very relatable to stand-up comedy. Me and Nick are from stand-up, as you know. You know, for Nick, you probably don't know that I do it as well, or maybe you do.
I do. Googled, yeah.
Oh, hello. Oh no!
she's really well prepared.
This again comes from being from a background in law, but I've no previous convictions. But again,
if you check.
Oh yeah, how did that come up? Well, I've got my jab tomorrow, which suggests I have underlying health conditions, but I'm interested to know what they are. I'm pleased, and also I'm perturbed. But in stand-up, especially when you start out stand-up, people would generally try and get 5 minutes as soon as possible. And then there's often competitions and things that are related to you doing 5 minutes of material, which is exactly what you did. So you've kind of, your start in stand-up is probably very similar to the way anyone would start doing stand-up.
Yeah. Yeah, and also I think there had to be a beginning. You know, when you're presenting a court, you know, a case in court, whether you're prosecuting or defending, you have to lay out a story because, you know, you can argue what the, often we're not arguing about the law unless you've been in the very, very senior courts. You know, you're arguing about facts and you're basically making a case. And even if your client's kind of pleaded guilty, you're mitigating and you're kind of making the case for why they should get there. You know, they shouldn't have such a heavy sentence. So I think the sense of having a beginning and a middle and an end and making sure that the beginning and the end have some sort of a link so that, you know, you don't kind of feel like you're drifting, I think was really good training for doing some of the stand-up. And so, you know, there had to be a story and the different stories had to link back to some overarching theme.
We're sort of jumping ahead because we haven't sort of put any groundwork into what we're talking about here, but me and Saeed met me and Baroness Saeed Avarsi met on a TV show that we made last November. Was it November?
Yeah.
In 2020. So yeah. I mean, so the way it came about was, I think I was asked in January before the pandemic hit whether I wanted to do this thing for Stand Up to Cancer. And I was just like, oh, yeah, that sounds good. And then the pandemic happened and then it got delayed. And then we ended up doing it in November. And there was a list of, from my point of view, Saeeda, there was a list of, so it was on Channel 4. It was part of Stand Up to Cancer. And it was a show that was called Stand Up and Deliver. And it was where five comedians would take on five celebrities and they would teach them how to do 5 minutes of, they teach them how to be a professional stand-up comedian in about 2 weeks we had. But it wasn't really 2 weeks. It was kind of less, much less than that. And and then at the end of it, there would be a show. And it was just on TV, wasn't it, a couple of weeks ago. So from last November, so we'll just do, we've dove in very strong here, Nathaniel. So let's just step back a bit. What have you been up to since November, Saeeda?
So it's been fascinating because I've had all sorts of people kind of contact me because I think on that program, well, we made the program in October, I think it was October, November, and then it didn't go out until, was it February, a couple of weeks ago.
Mm. And you won, by the way. Saeeda, so I trained, I mentored Saeeda and she ended up winning the competition.
It's because he mentored me that I ended up winning. Let's just get that clear.
That's what he wanted you to say. He's primed.
It's true. Absolutely true.
No, I think that probably is true, to be fair.
I was actually very conflicted. I think when you look at it, everybody had very different styles. I think all the celebrities had very different styles and all the comedians had very different styles. And I don't know. I think you would have done, I think Saeeda would have done well with anybody. And I don't know whether she would have won, but I know that she would have done well with it. Because out of everyone, she was the only contestant. Can we call them contestants? She was the only participant who kind of like, other than Richard Coles, who kind of is known for being a humorist in the first place, Saeed was the only person that sort of like came on and was kind of like, had sort of like the stage presence and kind of like some material, even though it was the stage presence of a Tory politician and not a stand-up comedian. I think that anyone could
which two very different things.
Two incredibly different
very,
things.
Very different.
Well, we were talking to each other, weren't we, Saeeda? And we were saying it's a shame how much they had to cut down in order to make the TV. I think they could have done an hour on each individual, and there'd have still been leftover material.
Yeah. But what I do say, Nick, is I don't think that I could have been paired with anybody and got the result that I got, because I think what happened was, I think because we were so different And because you're kind of, and I say this in the nicest possible way, I think because you're so out there and you're so kind of loud and you're so kind of, you know, kind of, you're such a huge performer in your performance. I needed somebody to be that big and that different to make me stop being so uptight. And I think if, I don't think any of the others would have done to me what, I mean, listen, are you to dress up, and you said to me, go away, can you dress up? And I got these kind of weird outfits on, and I walked out and you were running around with your underpants on over your clothes, thankfully. And I'm like, oh, I'm just going to ignore. He's got that. I'm just going to ignore that. I'm just, I mean, I literally had to do that. I was doing that typical English thing of stiff upper lip, nothing's happening, the boats are burning, but we'll just have a cup of tea, you know. And I tried so hard to keep that kind of reserve, and I'm not sure anybody else would have pushed as hard as you did to break that exterior to finally get me to flip, which is what I did. And it's only after I'd flipped that I then, I think, performed the best. So I think I would have had the material, but I'm not sure I would have performed it in the way that, because I tried so hard, as politicians do, to be nice and to please. But you taught me that actually you can do stand-up comedy and make people laugh and like you by actually not even trying to please them and just being a moody moo up there, which yeah. I think worked for the sketch.
Well, I think you came across as incredibly likable, and if that's something that you didn't, you know, deliberately do, I thought it was just a really good performance. What I would just to say, I think that out of me and all of the other comedians, I think I am the least like my stage persona in real life. I think when you look, so the other people were Jason Manford, Judy Love, Zoe Lyons, and David Baddiel, and I think that they are sort of basically extensions of themselves. When they're very similar off stage as they are on stage, whereas I'm doing a performance. So in terms of getting you to do a performance, I know what it takes to be one thing off stage and then something else. I have to, if it was just me going up on stage, I'm very sort of like shy and quiet, and, you know, just take away the size that you're a baroness. The fact that I had to, you know, after 8 months of lockdown, leave my house and meet a new human being in the first place, that was stressful enough to me. So I think that in order to get you to maybe a place where you were putting on a performance rather than being an extension of yourself, then maybe I was the right person. Yeah, I don't know. I just thought that I thought you did a really good job. What was it about? I mean, one of the other things, if I can talk about something that you said on camera that got edited, was that you're going to turn 50 this year, and it was like, yeah. it was on your things to do list. One of the things that you wanted to do before you turned 50 was to go out and do stand up. So my approach to the whole thing was, rather than, you know, and I think that I wanted to get the fact that I was brought up very left wing and very liberal. And so when I was paired with you, it was kind of like, oh no, this is anyone but the Tory baroness. But in actual fact, when we put that aside, it was just kind of like, when I did my first gig, I was 25, just about to turn 26. And I was like, I want to do stand up before I'm 26. And you were, I want to try this before I'm 50. So in actual fact, when you took politics aside, it was incredibly relatable.
I think when you get to, you know, I was coming up to 50, I'm 50 actually in a couple of weeks now, and it was the year I was coming up to my 50th, and you start to think, you know, I want to try and push myself in ways that I haven't before. And, you know, whether that's you jump out of a plane and do a skydive, or you do something, you know, for charity or whatever it is that you do. And when this hit my inbox, you know, normally if this had happened 5 years ago, I would have thought, oh God, no, you know, I'm not going to do this. But actually, I think it was a combination of, I'm nearly 50, I need to let loose, I need to lighten up, and I've been stuck at home with, you know, within this lockdown. Yes, I'll do this. And I think after I'd agreed to do it, literally within weeks, they'd started putting in, penciling in dates for filming. because it was just a tentative conversation in the early days, and I just don't think that they gave me chance to get off. But that very first day, do you remember when we first met? I just remember feeling sick. They interviewed me and they said, how do you feel? And I said, I just feel sick. I don't know why I've agreed to do this. I mean, it was such high risk. It had the potential to go horribly wrong. And, you know, we could have absolutely hated each other. We might not have worked well with each other. We could have just wound each other up. And I instinctively kind of had to get my head into the right place to say, you know, this has not got to be about people laughing at us. This has got to be about us making people laugh with us. And then obviously, you know, competitive side kicked in. And I don't know if you remember when you came to Dewsbury, I said, you know, Nick, this is about winning, isn't it now? Let's just get in. And once I'd got into that frame of mind to say, right, we're going to smash this and we've got to smash this, I think I felt like there was so much more at stake and we had to throw everything at it.
Yeah. Whereas I always think when you're concentrating on sort of the end goal, you sort of miss the process. So maybe we're a good partnership like that, because I think that there are no names mentioned, but I think out of the other people that were participating, there were quite a few competitive people that were doing it. And my goal was to get you to have 5 minutes that you wouldn't be embarrassed by. You know, I know what it's like to go on stage and be embarrassed.
I actually thought that we were the ones that were going to just make good television, because we were so different. And I was, you know, I'd got into the mindset to say, you know, we're going to make this work. And I genuinely think we got on, Nick. I genuinely think, you know, if you just kind of put the original, oh my God, we're so different thing, you know, I really enjoyed working with you. And he's actually, and this is probably, I hope this isn't going to ruin your reputation, but you know, he's a really kind Nat. And Nick is a really kind, nurturing person when he's not running around on stage screaming at people. He's actually genuinely a very good teacher and genuinely cares about what is happening in terms of, you know, your kind of performance. So, yeah, I think this bravado up front.
I absolutely think Nick has been a very kind person.
I wouldn't want to do this
every week if I didn't.
But I think one of the confusing things, not that I'm going to use this now as a platform to clear my name, but I think one of the confusing things is that with almost any other type of performance, maybe politics is an exception, but with almost any type of performance, when you stand up on stage, people acknowledge the fact that it's a performance. But with stand-up, you get up on stage and people think that you are that person on stage. And I would say 95% of the time, that's never true. You can be an extension, like David Baddiel is just as chatty off the, but he's in performance mode. He's not just doing kind of like jokes all the time. And it's kind of like, I think that if you say, oh, well, in real life, he's quite nurturing and all this other stuff, it's kind of like, that's the only reason why the shouting and the audience stuff works, is because I think people in the audience know that that is the joke. The joke is the performance. The joke is the way that you... It's the most unprofessional thing in the world to get up on stage and swear and shout at people that have paid to be there. So the joke is the fact that I am not that person on stage, but what if someone was like that? You know?
In TV terms as well, yours was the only one where you both had a story, whereas usually the contestants all had something to kind of get over, whereas you both had something to get over. So in TV terms, you probably had the most kind of narrative going on that would make a better piece of television. Well,
it's classic storytelling, though, isn't it? It's like 1980s.
They're the original Odd Couple.
Yeah, exactly. It's Lethal Weapon. It's Turner and Hooch. It's Tango and Cash. It's like they meet at the beginning. They get partnered up with each other. They don't get along at first, which we did. And by the end of it, they're best friends. Which I'm still
smashing it.
Still not 100% sure if you've accepted my friend request, but you're sure. But
I think now.
But Yeah, I know.
And, like, you and your other half are going to come for tea in the House of Lords. We're going to do posh tea when we've finished.
Well, you said COVID. Yes, you said, one of the things that we ended up cutting, Nathaniel, was because of COVID, was that I was going to go into your house and you were going to cook for me, weren't you? And you were going to come around my parents' house and meet my mum, try and win her over. I still haven't tried your cooking. How has your life changed since? So let's stop talking about me. How has your life changed since you did it? In terms of kind of, I think, well, just to finish on talking about me, I couldn't, when I worked in a bar, when I started doing stand-up, I couldn't make eye contact with people. And I found that through doing stand-up, my self-confidence grew and I sort of learned how to be a better version of myself through getting up on stage and performing. Have you noticed any changes in your life since you've kind of...
Yeah, definitely. So I think I'm riskier. So there's been a lot of... I've always had some weird and wonderful offers to do interesting things on television, off screen, and get involved in projects. And I've always been quite risk averse, I think, on lots of things, because I've always seen myself as this public figure who has to make sure that, you know, I don't become the story. We talk about the issues, talk about almost kind of, you know, I don't know if I told you that when I wrote my book, a lot of my friends commented on the fact that I got married, divorced and remarried in the sum of one paragraph. And they were like, where was the story? You just didn't tell us the story. And I think I've always tried to talk about the issues rather than me. Whereas I think what I did in this was I let people see more of me, and I talked about me and, you know, my story. And I think whether it's, you know, age and I was going down that route, I think this moment with stand up to cancer was a moment just to say, oh, you know what, F it, I can do this. And I don't have to be so cautious, and I don't have to be so reserved all the time, and I can take more risks. So I'm definitely much more of a risk taker. I've had some fantastic conversations about future TV and what that would look like. And it's interesting how even in some of the serious stuff I'm doing, comedy seems to be the undercurrent in that. And when I'm talking to people say, oh, my God, you can be so funny. And I think it's almost like another bow, you know, that another string that I've added to, you know, my kind of portfolio of I can also be funny. And I don't think people could see me as being funny before we'd done this. And I think that makes a difference. I can now officially say to my husband, who used to say, you just laugh at your own jokes and you're not really funny at all. Occasionally now I can say, well, I'm officially funny. I've got a trophy to show it. you know, so you can't say I'm not. And on Mother's Day, my kids bought me a T-shirt which says, I'm the Baroness, bitches. Become a bit of a catchphrase, which is a catchphrase now in the house. That's become a kind of bit of a mantra. I think I'm just generally a little bit more, I don't care. And I think you, through that process of learning that stand-up routine, I think the one thing that you did teach me, actually, Nick, was just to get up and say, I don't care. You know, I really need to. I think one of the things that you kept saying over and over again, I don't even remember this, is, oh, for God's sake, you know, you just be yourself. Because when you're yourself, you're actually quite funny and likable. And I think it took somebody else outside of my world to say that, to chip away at those layers. So, yeah, I think life has definitely changed for me. I think the kind of, you know, I never thought I'd end up doing television, and I'm now doing regular television, which is something that I never anticipated. I am much more kind of front-footed in lots of things, and I wear a T-shirt which says I'm the Baroness, bitches.
I agree, though. I think you were definitely the best one on the night, and I think you were more accomplished then I would say, if you went to an open mic comedy night and you saw people that were doing, starting out at comedy, they would be doing it at a much lower level than you were doing it on TV. So you're automatically much better, I think. And I think that is partly, I think, or maybe majorly because of Nick. And I think you were doing a different kind of performance style and probably a bit more richer than a lot of people would when they started. Because you're doing it kind of, part of the thing that Nick was bringing out here was getting you to rant which also feels like quite an advanced thing to do. Like, it's not something I do, and I think the stand-up I do is quite written, and everyone was doing something from a very written... it's basically, you write something, and then people memorize it and say it, but the performance element of it almost comes later. Certainly did for me, but you had kind of performance skills as well, which I guess comes from being a lawyer, and perhaps... I've sat in jury service, and one of the things you get from watching a trial is that the whole thing just appears to be you're just watching a piece of theatre. Everyone's performing, and also everyone kind of knows the outcome, which is the thing that sort of blew my... It's like, this is all... You're just watching something that's already been written. It doesn't feel like you're watching something that's... The ending could change. It feels like everyone here is doing this performance where all the people running it seem to actually know what the outcome will be.
But also, I think Nick did have a big hand to play in that, because I don't know, we spent half a day where all I was doing was coming out and saying, hello, my name is, and he was like, oh, for God's sake. Yeah, and he was just sending me back over and over again and saying, what does that sound like? What the hell is that? You know, and it was almost as if... Actually, weirdly, it's when Nick got me to the point where I didn't look like I was performing, that I was performing at my best, because once he'd stripped that back, and of course it was a performance, but I think when we hit that moment when we could make the performance look as natural as possible, it then felt, I think other people in the audience felt comfortable because they didn't feel like... And it was a stripping back of that, you know, where the performance is so performed that it actually becomes instinctively, and you're just coming out with things because you've just thought about it on the and that's why I think when somebody in the audience said something, I could come straight. It was a heckle, but I could come straight back at him because by that time I'd really kind of eased into just being comfortable.
That was incredible, because that heckle actually fed into one of your lines, and you managed to, you know, take something and make it spontaneous. And I think that that's the thing. My agent always tells me a story about when she first started doing working in comedy, and she went to see Jack D, and he was amazing. He was at the Comedy Store, and she left, and she's like, oh, it's amazing, all of that stuff. He just came up with it, and he said it. And, you know, he must have come up with it right in the moment, and then he just said it. And then she went to see him the next night, and he said the exact same thing. And I think when it comes to stand-up, there's some people that are sort of a little bit disappointed that it's written and it's rehearsed and it's that. But the skill about it... My agent left and she was impressed. She said, that's amazing. He made it look like he had made it up on the spot. And part of the skill of stand-up is to sort of like hide the writing and to make it feel like it's a spontaneous thought or a spontaneous conversation that you're having with the audience. And I think, you know, Chris, obviously, it's been ingrained in you for decades, Saida, how to be a public figure and to, you know, not, like you say, not let any of yourself away. And so you're very protective, you know, from coming from like the point of view of a lawyer and a politician. You know, it's sort of like we had to break that down and then just see who was underneath all of that. One of the things that I would say was absolutely okay. So, part of making this show, Nathaniel, was that a little bit of it. So it did sort of like several things. There was a bit of a stand-up show. So there was like an entertainment part of it, right? Where at the end of it there'd be some jokes, and then there was like the human interest part of it, where you see these people on screen struggling through it. Yeah. And then there's the charity element of it, where we're all doing something very good and we're raising awareness for stand up to cancer. And then there's also the part of it where we are filling up a TV slot here, right? We're making TV, right? So there was always like this contradiction within you, where it's sort of like, right, well, you're going to take Saida to a costume, to a theatre department, costume department, and you're going to dress her up in all these clothes so that you can kind of like get her used to being on stage. And there's part of me that's going, you just want us to do that because it's telly. There's no way that we would actually dress up in clothes in order to prepare for a gig. And I was, my argument with them was that I can see the benefit of taking Saeed to meet my mum and my mum showing all the costumes that she'd made over the years. And it's kind of like, these are all the costumes we made, but you've taken that one element of costume and you're trying to make some TV out of it by making Saeed dress up in all these, you know, ridiculous outfits. And then, you know, and it, visually it's better than two people sat around a table writing. Yeah. So I was sort of like very resistant of doing it. I thought it was a waste of a day because we only had like 3 days together, really.
Yeah.
We weren't allowed, we weren't allowed to talk in between.
No.
It's like every time we spoke, every time we spoke and they weren't filming, they'd say, stop talking, we want to film it.
We want to get that on camera. Yeah, you can, and then it won't sound right when you're on camera. You just want to kind of get everything out naturally.
So this costume day was just sort of like, this is a complete waste of time because, you know, what are we going to get out of it? And then what happened was we went into this little costume, which was weird because it's the Abbey Theatre, which is where, like, coincidentally, where I used to go for, like, drama club on Saturdays. I wasn't a football kid, I was a drama kid, right?
No.
And so they took us to this costume department where I kind of, like, grew up. And you picked out a bunch of costumes. There was like a couple of gowns. There was like a Guantanamo Bay-esque prison outfit.
It was brilliant, wasn't it? The orange jumpsuit.
There was you had like a cloak with a hood, right? And
it was like a blue Afghan burqa.
It was sort of, yeah. I can't remember whether it was velvet.
Also, they never really explained that on the TV.
No, I mean, it's kind of like, it was all really cut down, and there were like moments of days that were there, but like the whole of the afternoon where I met your friends and we went out for like a late lunch, that was all gone. It was like, we only spent Parliament. 3 days.
Do you remember Parliament? They put all of that out. The practice gig with some of the regulars.
I can sort of understand that because I think that everyone did sort of like a little practice gig, and it's kind of like they wanted to make it feel like we were all building up to one gig. But that was such an interesting gig. But so what I thought was a waste of time was getting you dressed up. But in actual fact, that for me was one of the most incredible moments, because when you came out, because when the first day I met you, you'd come in kind of like wearing kind of like your office outfit. So you look very sort of like professional. And you hold yourself a certain way. And when we did the costume day, when you came out wearing the orange jumpsuit, your whole manner about you changed, right? You came out and you were all sort of like slouching and it's kind of like you were kicking your feet as you walked. And then when you wore the ball gown, you held yourself in a completely different manner. And when you wore the cloak, you were completely different again. And for what I thought was a waste of time, in actual fact, it was just this, visually, it was this thing which I didn't really think came across in the TV show. I found it mind-blowing that your entire personality completely changed depending on what you were wearing.
I think it's probably a dangerous thing to say in case somebody's like the Home Office is listening, but I think I was born to wear an orange boiler suit.
you looked really comfortable, and but I learned something there.
Political statement, wasn't it? Nick, it was a political statement, and interestingly, it was after that when you said, "Well, what really gets you know? What's passionate? What makes you passionate?" And it was like jab, 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 and that's when I lost it, I think. And in that losing it, and I was like rant, 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 and it was kind of that was the moment when I suddenly became kind of it was the stupidity of politics that, and it, so it was very authentic. But then how did we, that was the moment when, I think it was the night before, wasn't it, the final gig. And I went away and I rewrote the whole material, didn't I? That was a scary moment. Yeah. That evening was scary when I rewrote literally 80% of my material.
Mm. Yeah, but it was, remembering it was the night before. I remember because I was in St Albans and my parents live in St Albans and I was, I think restrictions were sort of loosened up a little bit at the time. And I went to see my mum and dad. And I just remember being, I was nervous because, you know, when I first started gigging, I wouldn't, I'd get nervous like a week before the gig.
Oh, look, I've got to introduce you to somebody. I'll introduce you to Nick and Matt. The other half who doesn't think I'm funny.
Oh, but hello.
Now has to accept that I am.
I've heard about you.
All Nick's doing. Oh, Nick was absolutely great in teaching you.
I mean, we are sort of like, thank you very much. We are sort of like
got earphones in.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, we are sort of like trying to build up the myth that I had nothing to do with it. But yeah, I think he's sort of right. But when I first started gigging, I wouldn't sleep for like, I'd get nervous like a week, a fortnight, you know, and then as you get a bit more experience, it's the night before you get nervous, and then it's the day, and then it's like the hour, and then it's 5 minutes before you get on stage that you're nervous about it. But when the night before you did your gig, I was very nervous in St. Albans.
Yeah.
They
didn't really give us time to sit and write and think about material. We really had to be kind of left to go off and, you know, kind of write this stuff. So the very first time we were practicing a lot of the new material was, you know, at the 11th hour.
Mm. But yeah, it's the right thing to do. If you do a gig or you do some sort of practice and you realise that a lot of it doesn't work, it's correct that you rewrite 80% of it. You know, that's what you're supposed to do.
I don't even think it was that it didn't work. I think because like we were making TV, we weren't preparing for a gig, so any writing time that we really had would be kind of like, we had a couple of phone calls in the evenings, and then Saida would go off and she'd write stuff and she'd maybe try some stuff out, and I'd say, well, maybe that punchline and that punchline, but it was really, I felt like, my job to help her with performance, but also get her to a point where it didn't really feel like it was her first gig, but maybe it was like her 30th gig, where it's like somewhere along the line a little bit where, don't say that. I think one of the things about having your very first gig aired live on TV is the fact that we had the luxury, Nathaniel, of going on stage and failing and going home and drawing a line through that bit of material and saying, well, that doesn't work. I need to twist that bit of material so that I'm the victim in that joke. And then it becomes more, you know, so we had the benefit of like learning from our mistakes, which I think is 90% of what stand-up is going out, trying something, getting it wrong, and then trying it again. And I felt like it was sort of my job to get you to a point where we're getting rid of that, you know, law of averages, and we're getting rid of kind of like the possibility of failure, and we're kind of like getting to the point where it's just good stuff. And then you rewrote it all the night before, and then you went out and you did it.
But you know, the earlier material that we had was, I think I was playing it safe, whereas after that rant, I just thought, I think there was a moment that hit me on that evening where I thought, oh my God, all the stuff that I've always wanted to rant about and I dare not because it's unacceptable, I can now say under the guise of comedy and I can get away with it and I can actually be as out there as I want. And that's why when somebody heckled me and I said, I won't have that, what did you think, just because I'm a Muslim, I'm good with guns, you know, and I would have loved to have said that, but could you say that in politics, put your hell, but suddenly you're there, you're heckled on a stage and you can say the most outrageous stuff because it's comedy. It was quite liberating.
So you have literally, it wasn't just a joke, part of the, and we have people that listen from other countries, so try and find it on YouTube illegally or whatever. It was like some of the best telly I've been involved in. I was really proud of being a part of it. But you were genuinely on the ISIS kill list.
Yeah, for years.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, it was they published a list of 7 names in the UK and then various names internationally. And it was during the time that, you know, it was becoming quite difficult for people, foreign fighters, to travel to Syria. And so they put out a list of names that they asked people to target in their home countries. And so, you know, we had long discussions with the Home Office. Lots of things changed about the way I, you know, kind of conducted my life, and lots of things changed at home. And one of the things that we ended up having to do was to get a really well-trained, clever, angry dog, So the kids were like, yes, yes, mum's on a kill list. We're finally getting a dog. She wouldn't let us have a dog, and now we've got a dog. And then they kept, you know, there's a whole kind of sketch about the dog and how the dog, because I was just, I'm not as affectionate to the dog as everybody else is. So they reckon when ISIS do turn up, dog's just going to say, okay, you know what, bugger, take her. She's really nasty. I don't like her anyway. So he's not going to protect me. He's not going to protect me anyway. But it's, I mean, look, at the time it was scary. And I think it, my husband and my kids probably, you know, we joked about it publicly, but privately would worry, you know, because they had a sense of what that attack would look like. And you couldn't really protect yourself from it unless you literally decided never to go out anywhere ever again. So I just took the view that if this was going to happen, this was going to happen, and I was just going to carry on trying to live my life as normal as possible and joke about it. So in private, you know, kind of circles, I've always joked about it. But that was the first, and I didn't talk about it for a long time, but that was the first time that I thought, actually, publicly, I can talk about this. And that was, and the phrase, you know, I'm the Baroness Bitches, was actually aimed at ISIS, wasn't it? Am I bothered? Am I F? Actually, you know, I'm the Baroness Bitches, or, you know, up yours kind of thing. So I think it was a moment of, I suppose, frustration and relief, and also just being able to laugh about it and say, you didn't win, because I'm here on this stage taking the mickey out of you for trying to scare me into not living my life the way I want to live it.
But also there's that threat that's been put on you in order to sort of control you, right?
So to it's a way of...
Go on.
Yeah, I said it's a way of kind of saying that you, you know, it's a way of saying we're going to shut you down. It is a way of, you know, closing down your space and, you know, putting you on the back foot and making you feel like you can't say what you want. It's shutting down what you say. It's shutting down how you live. It's shutting down everything about you. And you know, somebody like me is a real issue for extremists, you know, for people like ISIS, because I am, you know, proudly Muslim. I am proudly British. I see no conflict in those. I see no conflict between being, you know, a practicing Muslim and a feminist. I see no conflict in you know, going out and campaigning on equal rights for everybody. You know, I have no issues in going out and campaigning on LGBT rights, pro-LGBT rights, but saying I am a practicing Muslim. And I think that when you kind of find a way in which you constantly look for those things that do unite us, and you can find the best in everything rather than what constantly makes us different and the worst of everything, then you are the ultimate extremist's nightmare, because what you're saying is that these crazy black and white worlds that you're creating don't exist, because here I am in the grey area. I am proving to you that I can be Muslim and I can be British and I can be a woman and I can be a feminist. And all of those collide beautifully in my life. So, you know, your story that you're telling doesn't ring true. So I think, you know, in an odd kind of way, it was a way, you know, extremists rely upon things being very simple narratives, and they're not. And our journey, in a lot of ways, Nick, was a kind of exploration of the fact that, you know, that there is never black and white. There is always many, many shades of grey, and what makes up different people's personalities and the different characteristics.
I mean,
sorry, I just made it really serious now.
No, there's 50 shades of grey. right. Can you just explain to me a little bit about this bill that's gone through that's restricting the ability to protest in England and Wales?
Gone through yet. So it's not come to the House, it's the police bill, and it's not come to the House of Lords yet. And this is obviously to be fair, this bill had been, this bill was coming down the track, not because of what happened with Extinction Rebellion last year, well, just before COVID, and then some of the anti-vaxxers stuff, and then, of course, Black Lives Matter. So it was a response to that, and that's why it's got all this stuff in around statues and the rest of it. And then obviously the tragic murder of Sarah Everard happened, and you know, the way in which that that evening was policed has kind of raised, you know, has really put the practical manifestation of that bill into the limelight, which is why now people are saying, what does this mean? And how can it be that we are closing down the space for people to protest? Now, look, there are two sides to this argument. We're not going to be entirely popular in saying this. You know, if you spent time in and around Westminster when the Extinction Rebellion protests were going on, not last year, but the year before COVID. Oh, I mean, it was horrendous. It was like day after day after day after day. And it wasn't, you know, it was impacting in ways. And if you looked at the, you know, I did used to question for people who, you know, of course, these people were committed to a better, cleaner world. They didn't half leave a lot of rubbish around whenever they were protesting. And they were damaging public spaces in the name of trying to protect the world. And so I think there is an argument to say, well, what do those protests look like? How long should they go on for? But and we need to not be able to have somebody camping outside Westminster. For somebody like me, who used to walk in and out of Westminster at that time, one of the things that used to go through my mind, now going back to exactly the conversation we've had before, is that there are so many people mulling around and we're not quite sure who everybody is, and there are tents everywhere. This actually provides quite an unsafe environment for me to be walking in and out, because it actually does provide a lot of space for the not great people to use this as cover to actually harm individuals. So I think there has to be some policing of protests. But I think the question in this bill is, does it go too far? Does it actually completely stop protests? And we all know, you know, even those of us that think that the way to effect change is through parliament, we all know that protest is absolutely a way to effect change. And if we didn't protest about things, and we didn't noisily protest about things and angrily protest about things, people wouldn't listen and you wouldn't be heard for those things to start to matter in mainstream politics and parliament.
Yeah, I think that's, I know what you're saying, but I think also in the example of Extinction Rebellion, a lot of it's also saying that change can be affected through media, right? So a lot of that is so people have those conversations in the media, and people feel that if they don't have that voice, that they want to do something that means it's going to get noticed. So if you're saying things like, if there was sort of damage or something, a lot of that is so it is reported. So it's almost that it's that kind of, the squeakiest wheel is like loudest, right? So I think in those terms, that's sort of two different things. Whereas I think to an extent, I think people have every right to do that though, don't they? Because they want to be able to get that message in the media, or have any way that you can get that message out if they're protesting. And I think they should have every right to do that. And I think that part of the way is not necessarily through politics, it's through that information getting out into the media. So I think that's a slightly different thing, that there's sort of two different ways of doing it. And certainly you can affect change through politics, but you can also do it by doing it. Presumably they're trying to get it noticed, or trying to make people notice that there is this, you know, there's this kind of climate crisis happening. And if that's not going to get talked about in the media, it's a way of doing it. Even if it's sort of perceived as negative, it does also mean that message gets out to people that might not otherwise hear it. And I think it is difficult.
But I mean, I'm a parliamentarian, Nat, but despite that, when the Trump visit was happening to the UK, I went out on a street protest. I walked out of parliament down, you know, Millbank, down Whitehall, and took part in a street protest against my own government on the issue of Trump, because I felt like that noisy kind of protest needed to happen, and I wanted to lend my voice to the chorus of voices saying this is wrong. But I do draw a distinction between now noisy, loud protest to make a point, and day after day after day of encampment where you are creating, you know, risk, and where you are, you know, I mean, I saw the rubbish in the streets outside Parliament, and I thought to myself, for people who actually care about a cleaner, greener world, you're certainly creating enough rubbish around here, and you're not making it very clean or very green. So I think that there has to be a point where protest has to be planned, protest has to be policed, protest has to be agreed all of these things have to be done within a, you know, a democratic kind of civilized society. But what we can't have is anarchy level protests that just go on and on and on and on for days and days and days and weeks and weeks and weeks, and actually start to, you know, to the point where, you know, it's starting to damage the very things that we think we're trying to protect. So I think that what I don't understand, and again, you know, I don't understand this kind of, we should be having a conversation about who we are, our colonial past, the fact that it's not all been good, and the fact that we will be stronger when we have honest conversations about our colonial past, right? We don't need to kick down statues to do that. But if after those conversations, society feels it's time to take certain statues down, or what my view has always been is leave the statue there, but leave a massive kind of plaque next to it saying, and by the way, this guy was a bit of a dick and he was a bit of a shit and he did all these crappy things as well. But you know what? We'll leave his statue here because it's always been there. So put up the statue to remember him, because that's what it is. It's a moment of celebration. But then put a plaque next to him telling everybody all the shit things he did. I don't have an issue with that. And that might be the compromise where people get to keep the statues and we get to have a bit of honesty, right? But what I don't like about this bill is this culture war that sadly my own party have created, where it's almost become to the point that where this police bill has become about statues, and where, you know, you've got colleagues of mine standing at the dispatch box saying to the opposition, well, which statues would you take down? Well, what the hell? What, that's typical culture war kind of space, and that's got to be where we stop, because our shared heritage has got great things, amazing things, but also crap things in it. And we will be a stronger nation if we can be proud of a Britain that is realistic, you know, with all its flaws, then try and live in some sort of weird parallel universe where everything we ever did was great. And it's false. I don't want to feel good about being, that's just as being on some sort of drug, you know. And if we want to kind of be on some sort of weird, some sort of kind of patriotic drug, which gives us an unrealistic view of who we actually were, I would much rather say, yeah, we did some great things, we did some crappy things, but, you know, at the end of the day, this is who we are as a nation, and let's look forward and, you know, acknowledge the mistakes we've made. Sorry, I'm on a rant now, aren't I, again?
That's all right. We have run out of time, though, so we won't be able to ask you about Home Alone 1 and 2 being your favourite films. But that's how it works. You've got,
we were told Home Alone 1 and 2, or was it the Home Alone series? Was it also 3 and 4?
It was all of them.
All right, okay.
We were wondering about how you felt about Home Alone 5.
What about Home Alone the Holiday Heist? Do you like that one?
I actually think Home Alone 1 and 2 were the better ones, right? I actually think they were the better ones. But I always think it's one of those movies where it doesn't matter
One of the more controversial things you've said the last hour. Okay. Interesting. Sorry to our listeners. We should have prepared you for that. Right, okay. So we're going to have to wrap up. We've got time to play the world famous game, Better or Worse. So unfortunately, Saida, I'm going to hand you over to Nathaniel Metcalf, and he's going to take over.
Better or Worse, Saida, and you just have to say whether the next person is better or worse than the person before, based entirely on my own opinion to score points.
Okay.
Beginning with Julia Roberts. Is Julie Andrews better or worse than Julia Roberts?
We've got to go really fast with this. Julie Andrews better or worse than Julia Roberts? Worse.
I think probably better. I think probably better. Robert Pattinson, better or worse than Julie Andrews?
Worse.
Judi Dench, better or worse than Robert Pattinson?
Better.
Chris Tucker, better or worse than Judi Dench?
Worse.
Patrick Swayze, better or worse than Chris Tucker?
Better.
Patrick Stewart, better or worse than Patrick Swayze?
Better.
James Stewart, better or worse than Patrick Stewart?
James Stewart.
Can't you just say the same?
No.
Isn't it like an eye test where they say red or green?
Yeah, it's binary. There's definitely
about the same.
They're high cards, Saida. Let's
this is like the culture war, Saida. It's one or the other.
Better, go on then, I'll give you that one.
Yeah, better. Rod Stewart, better or worse than James Stewart?
Worse.
Worse.
Worse. Rod Hull, better or worse than Rod Stewart?
Worse. Better? Worse? I don't know. The same.
No. We're having this. Pick one. Pick a side, Sailor.
Worse.
Yeah, you can have that. Emu, better or worse than Rod Hull?
Better.
Oh, better.
I'd say worse. Worse. You got a 9. Got a 9. That's a good score.
You got a 9. Well done, Sailor. Oh, you got an 8. Sorry, you got an 8. It's been, which means that you're bang average.
It's a mix. I want a recount.
Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for coming on.
Thank you.
Right, my name is Nick Helm. I've been on Fan Club with my mate, Nathaniel Metcalf. Say goodbye, Sailor.
Goodbye.
Welcome to the clubhouse.